This week in Retronauts, we talk about why gaming is like April. It's the cruelest month. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Retronauts. I'm Jeremy Parrish. And that was a little bit of literary heft for you from this video game podcast. I promise that that T.S. Eliot reference will be the most intellectual thing that will happen to you in the next 90 minutes. So please buckle in and prepare to be stupefied as we talk about things that are just too stupid. Why did they make these games like this? It's unfair. So here with me to protest the unfairness of the universe, we have an all-star cast of Retronauts people. I think I mentioned that I'm Jeremy Parrish, so I don't need to tell you that again. But let's see. We have a returning regular who hasn't been on the show in a while. Ray, from the West Coast, introduce yourself, even though I spoiled it.
From the West Coast, yes. Hi, it's Ray Barnholt, of course. Welcome. Thank you. Thank you for welcoming me. I'm welcoming myself. Hi.
From the far, far opposite side of the world, we also have our UK correspondent.
Oh, hello. I'm Stuart Gipp, and in addition to the literary heft that you just experienced, I'm here to provide some regular heft.
Phenomenal. Phenomenal. I'm carrying a few extra holiday calorie pounds as well. So this will just be a hefty podcast.
I mean, gravitas. What on earth are you insinuating?
Oh, sorry.
No, I'm kidding. Sorry.
Fine. Okay. I walked into that one. I probably should do a little more walking to get rid of those holiday calories. Anyway, finally, here also from someplace in the middle of the country. I don't actually know exactly where. You're just in one of those time zones that I always forget about.
One of the flyover states. It doesn't matter. Aww. I'm not here intentionally.
I grew up in them, so it's fine.
But hello, I'm Jess Voidberger O'Brien coming at you from a featureless room in the center of a dark maze that I do not have a map for.
And that's just her living room, folks. All right, anyway. So the title of this episode is Gaming's Cruelest Challenges. And this is going to be another one of those podcasts where I think we're just going to bellyache for 90 minutes and everyone's going to join in and punch down at video games that have already been beaten up on plenty. Now, hopefully we'll have some new insights to bring, and I, you know, am a fan of not just trashing video games, even if they probably deserve it. So I'm kind of curious to hear everyone's thoughts on why would they design games like this? Usually it's probably just going to amount to because they, you know, wanted to make more money. But there are so many ways to make money with video games, especially in the days before everything was a loot box, that I think that, you know, there's a good conversation to be had here. So please join me and the rest of this podcast crew as we talk about gaming's cruelest challenges. So I'm laying down some ground rules before we get started. This is not just like, oh, this video game is really hard. It's more about games that take a swerve, that just at some point, you know, you're enjoying yourself. Maybe it's a challenging game already. And you're, you know, kind of grappling with it. You're coming to terms with the reality of it. You're having a good time. It's escapism. It's fun. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, it just dumps something on you. Untelegraphed, unexpected, and it spoils the experience because it's just unreasonable, unfair. It doesn't fit. It's not cohesive with the rest of the experience. So that's what I'm talking about here. And sometimes those things are totally justified, but that doesn't make them any less cruel. So I guess since I've already talked for like 5 minutes nonstop, I'm going to let someone else jump in and start, and I'm going to look at the notes, and it looks like the first person on the list is Ray. So Ray, tell us, what is your inaugural cruelest challenge in video game, the one that sticks with you and just rankles?
Okay, well, I'm going to be the basic bitch today and warm up and give you all good old Super Mario Brothers 2, The Lost Levels. That would be the original disk system version. Now, we all know, or we're told, that this game is hard, and we've all had our Mario podcasts here where we've litigated it plenty of times, so I'm not going to pass any judgments here. It's not about that. I just want to serve up some things about this game for you. Now, it's true that it is harder. It is, its baseline difficulty is about where the first game ended at as far as level design goes and complexity, so Lost Levels just keeps going from there and introducing new gimmicks to throw you off, like the poison mushrooms, the super springs, the wind gusts. But those are gimmicks, and I would say arguably not cruel. They're surmountable, right? What is cruel in my mind are the trick warp zones that send you back multiple worlds, and there's not a lot, but they're mixed in with some of the more normal forward-moving warp zones. So there's one in World 8-1, so towards the end of the game, and it can send you back to World 5, for example. So be careful there. And that's like the one thing that really tricks you on. Now, what else is cruel is this barrier that they put up to accessing another four worlds of levels. Okay, well, first there's World 9, and that's the first secret world. And all you really have to do there is just beat the game, that is, finish World 8-4 without using any warp zones, and then you get this other bonus world.
Again, okay.
That's surmountable, I would say. I mean, especially if you got fooled by the backwards warp, then you're definitely not going to try to be bold enough to find one of those again. Mm-hmm. So if you got the stones to just, you know, go through another Mario game like that, you'll be fine. But if you want worlds A, B, C, and D, you have to beat the game 8 consecutive times. Pass World 8-4 another 8 times. And mind you, there's no saving or passwords in the original version. So this is just all endurance.
What if your power goes off or something? Like, how many hours would it take to achieve this without save states?
Right.
Is my question.
Hopefully you have some faith in the Japanese power grid, you know, back then, right? Or these days, you know, you can just do save states. anyway, that's what it was on the original version. Now, if you played this game first in Super Mario All-Stars, like we did on this side of the world, you know, they did soften those requirements a bit, mostly because all those games in All-Stars have progress saving, and so you can come back to things. And so it was less about sitting there all day and just trying to enjoy the crazy platforming with the Mario Brothers that we know and love so much. Maybe, guys? Lost Levels, right? Yeah, anyway. Really just the backwards warps and just that barrier to getting to the rest of the special worlds was just kind of like, wow, man, they really went for it. It is, like they said, for super players.
Yeah, you know, I don't really enjoy the Lost Levels in any of its myriad forms, but I do... I'm willing to stand up for it. I realize the fact that I don't enjoy it is because I am not an 11-year-old Japanese child in the year 1986. But if you were that child, unfortunately, I mean, just imagine there's so many good years ahead. But no,
boom economy.
No bubble economy here. Nope, the miracle's over. But, you know, this game really was more like an expansion pack to the original Super Mario Brothers as opposed to a proper sequel. I really feel like that's the way it was presented. It was, you know, Super Mario came out in September 1985. It was a massive bestseller. Everyone played it. The strategy guides were best-selling books. It was just ubiquitous. It's actually a little difficult to explain what a phenomenon this game was, especially the original Mario was, especially in Japan at the time. So, you know, once the disc system came out and they were able to make games cheaply and sell them cheaply, you know, for half the price of a cartridge, then they immediately said, whoa, the kids love Mario and they have gone to crazy lengths to master Mario. And everyone out there is an expert. Let's give them something they can really sink their teeth into. And so you ended up with the Lost Levels, which, you know, to a degree, I think, yes, that's very teeth sinkable. But I also think that they probably dialed it a little too far in the difficult direction, and I don't really think you see a lot of Nintendo developed and published games after that that go to quite such lengths to be difficult. You know, Zelda 2 was also pretty rough.
Yeah.
But that's about it. Like, they kind of
not for
back.
Like the entire game.
Like,
right.
There's a difference between like rough and mean. Like, it's just kind of mean to make someone do this 8 times. Like,
oh, yeah.
It's just unreasonable to do to somebody, 11-year-old Japanese child or not.
I agree. I mean, they had to go to school and everything.
Yeah. Like
that must have caused all kinds of delinquency, grades dropping as children sat up all night trying to finish Mario 2 the 11th time. Yeah.
Like the more recent Mario games, you know, in the past 10 or 15 years, they have their super special worlds with the super hard levels that people, you know, need to spend some time with, but it's not through the whole game. Like from the start, the Lost Levels is like, here you go, here's a poison mushroom, haha, and then, you know, deal with that. Deal with the rest of this for 50-some levels.
Yeah, and the fact that Mario 2 did not have any kind of save feature, despite being a disc system game... Like, I feel like that was a bridge too far, in my opinion. Like, they could have at least saved, you know, like, cumulative progress. Oh, you beat the game 4 times. Well, now you just have to beat it 4 more, not necessarily in one sitting. Go take a nap. But they didn't. They had all this rewritable media, and deliberately, like, that's a choice. They made a choice not to let children save their progress, because Zelda was the debut title on disk system, and that had save features built right into it. So, yes, there was an arcade mentality here, and that mentality was, we hate 11-year-old children.
Clearly.
1986 on Famicom, in a nutshell.
Pretty much.
It didn't occur to me that they had the capability of having it be saveable. I was just like, oh, it's probably because it wasn't, like, time yet. Technology-wise, to have this feature. And it's like, wait a minute. Wait a minute. They totally knew how to do this. This sucks. They did that on purpose. That's mean.
Yeah, it was Mario 2 was a cheap pickup. It was, you know, the Famicom cartridge was like $50, and the disc system game, I think, was 25 or 30.
Right. It was if you just got a disc system.
Yeah. Like you were going to buy this. And it's not like action games didn't have save features. There were lots of action games that had save features on disc system that lost them when they came to NES. Like Section Z, so much more manageable on disc system because you can save, you know, every time you beat one of the area bosses.
Oh, yeah.
Castlevania let you save. The original Castlevania and its dinky little 6 levels. Like, you know, in America, we had to just power through that and spend half our playtime just trying to beat Dracula. But on disc system, you could make it all the way up to Dracula's castle and be like, you know what? I need to go freshen up. I need to, you know, take a few weeks to kind of brace up for this fight. And you could do it. And you could just jump right back in and fight Dracula. But not in America. But not Mario 2. Nope. Forget it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that, like, even if you do go to get to worlds A through D, they're just, like, more normal levels. Like, you're going to want to see, like, something really cool, but you don't. It's just more Mario, at which point you don't want to play Mario anymore. You want to whip the disc out the window into the passing trash.
I would view it more as, like, well, you've been beaten so much for all the rest of this game. Like, I don't think anything could surprise you by the time you reach A through D.
I feel like they sort of got it. But I mean, I think World 9 ends with, like, I might be misremembering this, but it has, like, a special, like, stage with, like, messages and coins and things. So they kind of got it backwards, right? They should have had, like, the unlocks be the other way around. I don't know. It just seems like they made a mistake. In fact, they probably did, and we should try and interrogate Miyamoto about it at some point.
I think they felt more renewed when Super Mario World was being made. So, like, the special stages in Super Mario World are a bit more wacky, as well as being challenging, and so you do kind of get more of a reward for finishing all those, I'd say. You know, a personal mental reward, I guess. But, yeah.
Yeah, I kind of agree with Stuart. They could have leaned more into the weirdness, because by this point, all the kids knew how to get into the so-called minus world on both the cartridge and the disc system. They worked differently. They were different. So they expected weird stuff, like, you know, a stage full of Bowsers floating around like they were squids or something. And Mario 2 never quite goes that far. So another missed opportunity. Okay, have we beaten up on one of gaming's most beloved franchises of all time yet? have we done that enough yet?
In general, no.
Oh, okay. Well, let's move along anyway, since this isn't just the Dump on Mario podcast, but we might come back to Mario later. I don't know. Maybe it's on someone's list. I'm going to jump over to Stuart now, because Stuart is bringing the science, and by the science, I mean 8-bit microcomputer games from the UK, which I don't think there were any of those that weren't cruel. So this is going to be very elucidating.
No, there's a punchline to this. And I just want to apologize in advance to any of my Retronauts website readers, because I have written about this before, so I'm going to sort of be doing the greatest hits now. I can't remember if I've talked about it.
It's a different medium. It's all good.
Yeah, exactly. it's money for old rope. But basically, one of my favorite games as a kid was this game called The Candlelight Adventure on the Spectrum, which is the third game in a series called Ollie and Lisa. I've never seen the first two or know anything about them. Doesn't matter. Don't even think about it. But what it is this sort of single screens adventure game, 2D platformer, where you take control of this horrible little thing. God knows what it's supposed to be. And the basic mission is he wants to assemble a car from car parts that are hidden all around this world. I don't know why. I didn't really bother reading the tape inlay. I just know he needs the car parts. That's all I do know. And I think what I generally like to do with this is, what I like to do is I like to ask the people listening when they would tap out of this, like as I keep revealing more nuance to how shitty it is, because it's really bad. And remember, this was my favorite game. So I had a bag of 40 games that we got secondhand, and this was my favorite one of those 40. All of the rest the worse than this. I love the Spectrum, but it's a tough love, you know. Yeah. Anyway, so you've got this big castle. You're a little fella. You have fall damage. You can't fall too far without taking damage. And when you do fall, the damage process is you sit there for, I want to say, about 8 seconds, maybe 10, before you get back up again. And that's also when you get hit by an enemy as well. So if you fall off something, you'll take damage. You'll stand there. As soon as you recover, you'll be hit by the enemy and you go back into the damage loop again. The enemy will then disappear, but there's every chance it may respawn by the time you're back up. So that's the first problem I have. Looking for these car parts, the most prominent problem with them is that they're invisible. You can't see them at all. There's nothing that indicates where they are. You can get hints, but the way you get them is that you have to find a telephone in the game. And when you walk up to the telephone and press the button on the joystick, he'll do a little brief conversation. This is another 10 seconds or so animation. And then an arrow will appear. And the arrow appears in a thought bubble. It's right, left, up, down. You get it. Now, the problem is all the arrow does is point to a door, because the it's single screens with doors, you know? Mm. You can go in a door and you'll warp to another screen. The following problem is, if you go in a door and you go to another screen, then go back in the door you came from, you may end up on a completely different screen. And then if you go back in the door again, you may end up on a fourth different screen. These doors don't make any sense. So you could draw a map, but you'd be drawing what can only be described as a ridiculous chart.
I would have been out by that point once I realized that the doors don't consistently go to the same places. I peace out at that point. No.
So let's say you've got an arrow that says go right. There's a door there. You know that somewhere through that door there's going to be a car part. The problem is it could loop back to somewhere that you accessed from the left earlier. It doesn't make any sense. Don't worry about it. Forget that. The clues are useless. They have no function. So next thing you need to do is, if you know where a car part is, or if you've intuited where it might be, if you walk up to it and press the button, it doesn't do anything. You have to find a magnifying glass before you can even do it. When you use the magnifying glass, you have to watch about 12-second animation of him looking left and right through the magnifying glass. And if he doesn't find anything, he'll sadly tuck it back into his pocket, which is another 8 seconds or so of him sort of shrugging. If you do find it, the screen will flash, the little window will appear with a picture of the car piece, and it's you got the car piece, and your magnifying glass is deleted. It's obliterated from existence. You no longer have the magnifying glass. It's gone. Now, what you've got to do now is you've got to trying to think of the best way to explain just how hard this is. You can't hold more. Yes, there's so much more. I'm really
Christ.
Sorry. This has been my big. This is my main event for the episode.
Wow.
Okay? You can't hold more than one car piece.
Sorry, I need a snack. I'm gonna get comfortable.
Snack, and is that snack poisoned by any chance? No,
it might be by the end of this. Yes,
but I'll keep it quick. You can't hold more than one car piece.
No. I'm not rushing you at all. I'm okay. Saying I'm gonna get comfortable. So take your time.
Yeah,
I'm having a snack and getting comfortable. So regale us.
So you can't carry multiple car pieces. So you have to go to the garage and drop the car piece off. Now, this
dude,
is a
screen. How do you know where it is? What the hell?
Well, that's the thing. You don't. Like the first time I got to the garage, I thought I'd finished the game. But no, you have to take it to this garage, which is probably about 30 or 40 door screens worth of traveling.
What?
To drop it off. And then once you've dropped it off, you can now get another car piece, but that means you have
to
find another.
So
yes.
You have to warp through doors at random to get back to the garage. Is that correct? Okay.
Well, I mean, you can learn how to get there as you play the game. You can learn what gets you where, because there is some kind of logic to it, but when you're a kid, it's really not easy. And when you're an adult, it's really not easy because you don't want to. You know?
Right.
But anyway, you get this car piece, you drop it off, it's there, you're like, great, got it. Let's go get another one. You go and find another magnifying glass, you go and find another car piece. I think there's about, there's at least 10 of them somewhere in this world. Now, I think the basic aim of the game is you need to find out where they all are so you can get them in the most efficient order so you won't have to backtrack as much. But you're always going to have to do at least some ridiculous amount of traveling because one of the pieces is very near the beginning of the game where the garage is the end of the game. If you see, I mean, it's completely sort of non-linear in that respect. But the problem is, there's a time limit.
Shut up!
Yeah. Of course.
Yeah, you have... in fact, there isn't actually health, which is probably the only friendly thing about this game. When you take damage, like I said, you're sitting there for a good 10 seconds, and that's your health. That's your time ticking down. So every time you're wasting time, you're just going, come on, move!
That's
come
so on. Stressful! Mm-hmm. Oh my God!
You can get more... oh, no, sorry, I'm slightly mistaken. There is also health. I'm wrong.
Oh, good,
you can
good,
also
good.
Just die. Sorry, I forgot about that. But no, you can
you
get
mentioned
more
fall damage, so I'm like,
yeah. You can get candles that extend the length of your time limit. You can get health hearts that extend your health. But the problem is that they don't respawn, and there's only so many of them in the world, so you'll have to like factor in when is the most efficient time to get them, and also do you even have enough time to finish the game? Because it's really unclear. The only way to tell is this really unobvious graphic of the candle that's kind of melting away. And I'm sure there are elements of this that I'm not even remembering sort of the hostility of, because I never finished this fucking game. Because of course,
I have a question.
Yeah, of course.
Absolutely. Your little man, I have a question about motivation. Why are you building a car?
I think it's so he can drive his girlfriend somewhere or something, Lisa or something. I think she won't like leave the castle unless it's in her favorite car or something.
I don't know if it's worth really it, classic, dude.
It's a really classic microcomputer premise, you know.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of microcomputer games about like how awful women are.
Unsurprising.
I hate to say it. Hey, come on, like, it's not my fault. Well, I suppose it's not entirely my fault. But, you know, as a nation, we spawned some awful things. And this is probably the worst of them. So, my favorite game on the Spectrum. One of the friendliest Spectrum games, genuinely, that I can think of.
Yeah.
Was this system like a torture device for like prisoners or something? Like,
yes, it was a torture device for children whose parents weren't rich enough to buy a Commodore.
Made by Scotland Yard to break people or something? Mm.
Well, no one actually paid money for Spectrum games. They just copied discs from each other. So as a result, every game was punishment for having been stolen.
Cassette
so
tapes.
It was just kind of like a self... Oh, sorry, cassette. Yeah. My mistake.
That's okay.
No, but yes, like every game is like this, you know, kind of self-flagellation loop. You steal it and then you play the game and then you regret having stolen it.
Yeah.
You're chastened.
Yeah. It's
humbled.
The crime is its own punishment. And, the best thing about it is I would sit there it would be like, okay, it's Spectrum time. Because I couldn't just go on it whenever I wanted as a little kid. It was like, you can play on the Spectrum now. It's like, yes, Ollie and Lisa time, slam it out. Shove the tape in, sit there for 10, 11 minutes, like, it's coming, it's gonna load soon, I'm gonna get to play Ollie and Lisa.
Yeah.
And then, I think the most car pieces I've ever got is 2, and that's including when I was an adult and I was a little bit more aware of what was going on.
Wow.
So yeah, it's really horrible and I love it and I'll always love it, I think. And you know, I think that's why I'm here, you know, and I don't mean here on Retronauts. I just mean that's why I'm
alive
here
today to tell the tale.
Yeah. Yeah.
I will shout out that I'm looking at screenshots of this game. I think it's really, like, the graphics are kind of nice. I can tell what I'm looking at. Mm, like, the colors are very pleasing.
Game.
Like, it's well illustrated at the very least. So you've got that going for you. You're picking up things. You have no idea what the hell this doodad is.
Yeah, it makes good use of the aesthetic, I think. It is a nice looking game for a Spectrum game, but unfortunately it is like being, like, stabbed with a million tiny razors. So.
Yeah, with pretty-looking razors, I guess.
Yeah.
Aesthetic razors.
All right. More Sterling software from Europe. Thank you.
Anyway, Jess, why don't you tell us about your cruelest experience in video games, or one that you find sufficiently cruel to tell us about?
Oh, it's so hard to follow up Stuart's pick, though. Just keep that in mind. It's a hard act to follow. I'm also talking not from firsthand experience, but my spouse recently did a Let's Play to fulfill some sort of charity promise that was made to do a Let's Play of Zork. And I've not played Zork myself. Obviously, it's a very famous text adventure game. No graphics, blah, blah, blah. Okay, those are all difficult. But I did not know that Zork had, like, more than one maze in it. And I have a map of this maze in front of me. And I'm like, what the Christ am I looking at here? but so there's more than one of these bastard mazes. This is a mess of a map. You never get a map in the game, obviously. So you'd have to buy a guide or something like that, or attempt to make something that made sense, because this map does not make sense. The dungeon or whatever you're in doesn't make any sense. Like, in the very first room of this maze, if you go north, you loop around to the same room over and over again, but you don't know that. Like, it never tells you that you have gone to the same room. So you could go north forever and have no idea that you're standing still, practically. So that's cool. And besides these warp-style, you know, loopy-loops, there's also just regular dead ends. So you would think this, like, oh, well, if dead ends exist, there wouldn't be these warp points that send me back to the same room I'm in. So there's no, like, logic that follows through there. You'd kind of have to just... I don't know how you would surmise this. But you might be clever and be like, oh, like, I'm going to try to Hansel and Gretel this shit. I'm going to leave a little trail of breadcrumbs behind me so that I can tell where I've been and where I haven't been. But too bad, sucker. That doesn't work because there is a thief in the maze that is just around randomly.
And like,
if you leave something on the floor, this guy will come and probably pick it up, and you'll have no idea if you've been in that room or not. I think you might actually be able to run into this thief on the same, like, square, and he'll kill you or something. That's cool.
You can have different interactions with him, actually.
Oh, yeah?
Which is one of the kind of cool things. Like, you can give him one of your prizes, and he's like, oh, thanks. And he walks off, and then you can't get the points for that item, but at least he won't kill you.
Oh, you're bribing him.
But actually, he's essential to solving one of the puzzles, now that I think about it.
So. Oh, really?
Yes, but I don't want to spoil that for you.
Oh, no. I was definitely going to play it after hearing about how bullshit this maze is. But yeah, there's also, I thought this was wild too. I didn't know this, but there's stairs in some of the rooms of this maze, but it doesn't, like, point it out to you. You just have to, like, be like, go up, and it'll, like, let you go up or down. So in addition to your cardinal directions, you have to deal with up and down in this maze. And yeah, none of these rooms logically connect to each other. They go all sorts of places. They're not just in a row, or a door goes someplace that makes logical sense. So yeah, this seems like a nightmare. And I also just noticed on this map that in some room there is a useless lantern. So that makes me happy.
Oh, go goody.
Ooh, yay. So that's what I've got on Zork, something that I haven't played myself, but I heard a lot of secondhand, like, wow, this is bullshit information about.
Yeah, there's I recognize this map that you embedded in the notes. It's from the Zork Anthology, I believe it was called.
Oh.
A collection that was released in the early 90s. So all you had to do to beat this maze was wait for 10 years and buy the new collection that came out for a different system. And then you would have a maze given to you that would kind of guide you through.
Yeah. Were there any, like, guides for Zork out there for purchase?
Yeah, there were.
Was it like a phone number that you rang, or was this like...
Oh, it might have been a phone number. I wonder.
Yeah, and it cost $6 a second.
Right?
Yeah.
No, in Infocom, you could buy tip books and clue books for them. And I believe... I know some of the games came with InvisiClues packed in, where it was like, you know, the invisible ink, and you would use a marker.
That's lovely.
I think you could buy those separately for some of the games. So there probably was a tip book for Zork. And I really wanted to lift the InvisiClues thing for our Plumbers Don't Wear Ties strategy guide, but it's very, very expensive to do that. And there aren't a lot of printers who have the ability to use that invisible ink anymore. So that was a disappointment. We came up with something different, which I think is still good, but, yeah, so that is kind of one of the hallmarks, you know, the memories. If you played Infocom games back in the day, you definitely experienced InvisiClues, because that was really the only reasonable way to finish these games. They were, some of them had really smart, clever puzzles, but all of them eventually got to a point where you're just like, wow, I'm trying to think like the designer, but the designer was probably not entirely sane, and I can't think like that. I can't bend my brain sideways. So.
Glaring at the Hitchhiker's Guide game right now.
That was the one that... Stuart, would you like to be on the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy episode in the near future?
I would.
You would? Oh, that's fantastic. Oh, great. Okay. I'm looking forward to
it. Is the Hitchhiker's Guide episode just me, like, locked in a room having to play the game?
No, we actually did kind of like a little bonus episode where we tried to get through the Hitchhiker's game, and I think we might have gotten to, like, I think we died a couple of times, but that's it.
Yeah, that sounds likely, yes.
Anyway, so please look forward to that, everyone. But yes, Zork definitely had some moments like that, for sure.
I like the fact that the only discernible ways out of this maze are two troll room and two cyclops room. I mean, they would sound pretty bad.
They both don't sound like great options, you know? And no. I don't know the goal. Like, I'm looking at this map, and it's just like, where do you want to be?
I mean, I think I would try and make my way to the center and maybe use that knife to, you know, get out of the maze in a slightly darker way, maybe. No.
The rusty knife.
Well, there's also an exit to the grating room, and I don't know if that's like room. There's a grate in there,
that
or if
sound
it
good
is like grating on your nerves.
No, like it grates
or if it grates you like cheese.
Yeah, like a carrot.
You go in there and it's like someone sort of sliding one of those like school chairs across like a plastic floor just constantly. That would be awful.
Yeah, I think Zork 2 had a puzzle where you had to get on a carousel and it would deposit you in a random direction after you got off. And there was also a puzzle that turned out to be like a game of baseball, which was indecipherable for anyone who wasn't from the US or Japan, because they're the only countries that like baseball. So everyone else in the world was like, what the hell? So I don't know if you can vouch for that.
I mean, I just had to play like 50 baseball games for the Game Gear directory, and I'm honestly none the wiser.
That makes sense. Yeah.
There you go.
You got guys, you got people standing on like mounds.
They run in circles.
They run around a bit. I don't know. Sometimes, I don't know. It's not fair. It's not fair, man. They just keep catching the ball, and it's not fair.
All right. I'm going to jump in now and do my first entry in the round robin, which is actually, I'm going to cheat. It's going to be multiple entries because I've been playing some really freaking obnoxious games for NES Works. And all of them just kind of clumped together, not in like a Katamari. It's more like a dung ball of misery. Oh, that's not entirely fair. Like, Monster Party is actually a pretty fun game. Like, Monster Party is famously weird. It has a very surreal sensibility to it. It plays pretty well. Like, the balance between, you know, you can be the little kid with the baseball bat who has really short range, but he can hit projectiles back at enemies and kill them in a single shot. That's fun. Or you can be a demon that flies around and shoots lasers. Always a good time. It's a solid game. It's really well made. But apparently, when they converted it from the Japanese version, which never actually came out, and released it for the US, they decided, for some reason, to add an extra boss to the next to last stage, the tower. So instead of having two bosses in the tower, there are three. Okay, sure. None of them are difficult. Like, I mean, okay, one of them is tough if you're not the demon, but they're all manageable. But the thing is, to clear every stage in Monster Party, you have to defeat the bosses until you collect a key. And you collect a key by defeating a certain number of bosses. So in the tower, you have to defeat two bosses to get the key. But there are three bosses because they added the extra one. And they didn't think to change... Ooh. This is according to the cutting room floor. They didn't think to change the programming code to look to see how many bosses you had defeated, to recognize that you had defeated two or more. It looks to see if you have defeated two bosses. So when you defeat a second boss in the tower, you are given a key. But if you go into another room and defeat the third boss, you will suddenly lose that key. And the thing is, the game doesn't drop icons or give you any indication whatsoever that you've gotten a key aside from a tiny little icon in your power-up bar, like your health meter bar at the bottom of the screen. So it's very, like, subtle, and you probably won't even notice that you have suddenly lost your key until you get to the end and you can't exit and you have no idea why. And you go back down the tower and all the boss rooms are empty and there are no hidden spaces or anything like that. And you think, you might think there would be because the level before the tower is actually a door maze, kind of like what Stuart was talking about, except logical and consistent. So you might think, oh, well, there's maybe a secret that I'm overlooking. No, it's just you can't beat all the bosses in the tower. You have to skip one. But there's no way of knowing that.
You just soft lock yourself.
Oh, God.
You soft lock.
That's worst thing.
The only way to beat the tower at that point is to die and have to, you know, continue. And you start at the beginning of the tower, but when you start a continued game, you start with much less health than you're probably going to go into the tower with initially. So it becomes much harder to do the second time through.
No.
So that's really cool. I don't know if we can necessarily count that as a cruel challenge because it is sort of unintentional. I don't think they meant to do this by design. It's just one of those things.
I have a similar one on my list, by the
way. Neglect is a form of cruelty. Neglect is a form.
Yeah, I'm with Stuart. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Fair enough.
I like that. It's like some kind of Sierra thing, except worse because they didn't mean to do it.
Yeah. Right. I think oversights count as long as it's the result that matters, you know?
When you're trying, it's the worst. When you can't progress and you don't know if you've just done something wrong and it turns out, no, it's just fucked. Brilliant. It's like life, isn't it? Just like life.
Perhaps the cruelest challenge of all is one that is not your fault and you fell into because somebody else made a mistake.
That's true. That's what it's like to be a voter nowadays.
We're going to get existential. Yeah. Oh, no, you just... Oh, they're going to get something.
I got political.
God damn it.
Gotcha, gamers.
Yes. All right.
Oh, they're going to get some
So kind of related to the Monster Party one is a case where the developers discovered a glitch and said, oh, that's so horrible, we're going to keep it. And that's Ninja Gaiden for NES, where when you normally... When you make it to a boss at the end of, you know, world 1-2 or 1-3 or whatever, 2-3, 3-3, etc., if you die against the boss, it'll send you back to the beginning of the stage right before the boss. So you have to fight your way back. That's tough, but it's not totally unmanageable. In world 6, the final world, when you make it to the final boss and you die, instead of sending you back to the beginning of 6-3, it sends you all the way back to 6-1. With the notable fact that 6-2 is one of the hardest video game levels ever created. It is phenomenally difficult.
It's horrible.
Just absolutely brutal. World 6-3 is also not a cakewalk, but 6-2, crazy. There are three forms to the final boss, and if you don't get a health reset between them, you also don't get to like to refill your special attacks. So if you make it past the first form of the boss and die against the second form of the boss, you get sent back to 6-1. The first form does stay dead, but the only way not to have to recover all that progress is by beating all three of those bosses in a single run, which is, I did it as a kid, but that's because all I did from, you know, from like for 6 months of my life was play Ninja Gaiden. So I got really good at it, but I cannot do that now. Like just getting to the final boss when I did my recent NES Works episode, I was so proud of myself for even getting there that I said, you know what? Well done. Mm. I beat the game. So I didn't get to see the ending cutscene, but that's okay, because I've seen castles fall before. How many times have I beaten a Castlevania? So many. Anyway, but that was a glitch where they were like, that makes this game balls hard. Let's keep that. It's incredibly, unbelievably rude. So yes, let's just keep that in here and not fix it.
So they definitely knew about it?
Oh, they did. They've said, yes, in interviews. They were like, oh yeah, that wasn't supposed to happen, but we liked it, so we kept it.
Wow.
Thanks, guys.
Can I just interject and say that one of the most liberating experiences in being a gamer is when you realize that it doesn't actually matter if you don't beat the final boss.
Yeah.
You can just watch the ending. I'm only recently getting this out because, real quick, I've been playing Borderlands 2 and, like, the bosses in that game are just so dreadful. And today I was just like, you know what? I'm not doing this. I'm just not going to do it. I'm just moving on. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
No, I won't get the achievement. Who gives a shit?
I think as you grow older, part of becoming a more mature person is learning to respect your own time.
Mm-hmm.
And be like, I don't need to prove this to anybody. Mm. What am I doing?
Right.
Am I having
very
fun?
Valuable to, yeah, it's very valuable to learn if you're a child playing Ninja Gaiden. Like, mm-hmm. I'm good. Time for snacks.
Do you think that the kids who did that were the kids who became like surgeons?
No, because they messed up their hands and their eyes playing this video game. I mean, look at me.
That's fair.
I think video games, you know, NES games taught an entire generation of children about the sunk time fallacy, the sunk cost fallacy. But I think we all learned the wrong lesson. So that's very unfortunate.
To just be more stubborn is the answer.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Just we dig our feet in, we're entrenched. Some more NES ones, but I don't want to take too long, so I'll come back to those after this next round, Robin. Let's jump back over to Ray. Ray, okay. What's next on your list? I see your list. You've got some nice, juicy, obscure ones, so let's go.
Thanks. First of all, actually, I have an addendum to Mario.
Wow. I forgot to mention. We're back to punching on Mario.
Get him! Get him!
When you,
the movie sucks.
When you unlock World 9 in Super Mario Bros. 2, they only give you one life. So you do have to finish World 9 with one life. I forgot to mention that. So
what the hell?
It's for super players.
Wow.
Okay. Well.
Yeah, and you can't continue, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Thank God that's not true of real life.
Okay. Yes, my next game here is Unlimited Saga for PS2. I don't know how familiar you are with Unlimited Saga, Jeremy, but feel free to help me fill in some gaps if you can. I don't know. But
so with Unlimited Saga, actually, it's not Unlimited Saga. It's just Unlimited Saga. They didn't capitalize the G because they were like, this is too weird even for this series. I played a bit of it and said, I really respect the fact that they created this and I do not want any part of it. So I can't help you too much here. Sorry.
All right. Fair enough. I'll try my best. But this is maybe the most maligned of all the Saga games. I remember this Japanese magazine called Continue. I think they named it one of their Kusoge of the Year. So there's an indicator of where it was at. And, over here we had the Final Fantasy Legend games, but also the Saga Frontier games for PS1. And those were also a little bit quirky, but people did end up liking those over the years. Unlimited Saga, not so much. Unlimited Saga, it's a Saga game, but it featured no graphics. Okay, just kidding. What I mean is... most of the time, you would move around maps and dungeons and stuff as if you're moving a piece around a board game. Mm-hmm. And that's just one of the visual elements of it. I thought it was amazing that Square Enix decided to localize it for English markets because they did the bare minimum to market it. So I have the back of the box here. And some of the ads, too, they read, I quote, "Only those brave enough to accept this challenge can experience 7 adventures beyond imagination." And then also a call out here to visit the Hall of Valor at usaga.com, which says, "Our entire online community awaits brave challengers." And I will add that this also just happened to be one of the few Square games to not get an official Brady Games strategy guide released alongside it. Romancing Saga did later, but not this one. So Square Enix just kind of translated it and said, good luck, because this is all you're getting. And it would have helped, because some of this is kind of obtuse to a lot of people, especially if you're just like coming off of playing Final Fantasy X or something. But I'll get into that. One of the main gameplay things in Unlimited Saga is called the real system, R-E-E-L. It looks kind of like a Halo ring laid over the screen, but it kind of moves like a slot machine reel. That's what they're going for there. And it's basically used for almost everything you do in the field. So like opening chests, treasure chests with a success fail state can be kind of like by chance or by skill. Like you have to stop the reel on the success marker.
I'm loving this.
Or else you can get the failure marker, or you can get like the dynamite marker, which is like a failure plus a bad effect. So there's that. And it's also used in battle a lot. So it determines the effectiveness of attacks and spells. And I think missing or hitting. But some people would hear that and be like, well, with that and like moving pieces around the board, it's like, the real thing is like a dice roll, right? And mm-hmm. the board game movement, like tabletop RPG players can understand that kind of uncertainty. And I think if you're working on a Saga game under Akitoshi Kawazu, the creator of it, you're probably one of those nerds to begin with. But I think for most people, especially on this side of the world where there were not a lot of Saga games released, I think it threw people off because it looks like you need great timing for this real stuff, on top of paying attention to everything else that the Saga games are known for and don't tell you a lot about. So like life points over hit points and how open-ended you can grow your party and stuff, how everybody can basically use any kind of weapon and just be customized very, very loosely however you want. And what I was getting at earlier is that I think most people playing console RPGs aren't looking to think too much. And if you come into this expecting a Square Enix jaunt like Final Fantasy to have your brain off a little bit and just enjoy cutscenes and stuff, you're just going to hit a wall like within minutes and give up out of frustration. And Unlimited Saga just, I think, abstracted things enough with the visual stuff and the board thing that it just kind of, that's what it did to a lot of people. The other thing is that, you know, with that board game movement, it's kind of like a level of skeuomorphism that people weren't expecting, I think, again, from a Square Enix game, especially one that otherwise does look kind of decent. Like Unlimited Saga, they got those fancy comic style cutscenes. They got amazing music. They got great sprites and the battle scenes that I think the Frontier games were known for. But I think for most people, just became kind of upsetting. And I also think they didn't follow through enough with kind of the tabletop sort of visual goals of it, because that also runs the risk of confusing people when you have these other sorts of elements that look more like expected of a modern game. And to that, I would also bring up, like, a decade later, we got Crimson Shroud for 3DS from Yasumi Matsuno and his crew. And that's a game that is, like, unapologetically a tabletop game, like, on your 3DS, where you are tossing literal dice and moving literal figures representing your heroes, and there's no mystery as to what you're getting. Similar to that, also, even more recently, like, Square Enix came out with a game called Dungeon Encounters, which just looks like straight-up graph paper, but again, you see that, and if you just want to drink the chemical compound that gives you a computer RPG, and with nothing else dressing it or spicing it up, like, you get that. You get that, and you want it, you get it, and we're now more attuned to those sorts of things. But Unlimited Saga just did not hit at all, for the most part, and otherwise, like, on a high level, it is just a regular Saga game. It plays a lot like all of the other Saga games. It's just kind of this real system stuff just really turns people off, and just didn't work. And that's basically the nutshell I got for Unlimited Saga. Thank you.
I really think that this game existed and was localized because Akitoshi Kawazu cashed in all of his chips. You know, this was around the same time that Hironobu Sakaguchi left the company and, you know, like, Final Fantasy The Spirits Within was a flop. So all of a sudden, Kawazu was kind of like the guy who had been there longest. And I think he was like, all right, here's what I'm doing with my seniority. Yeah. I'm making this game. And I had an interview with him once where he said, like, I know, you know, this is not a game. This is not the kind of game other people would like, but it's something I wanted to do. So
precisely.
The man just, like, used all of his political capital in the company in one shot, and this was it. He got to make the weird tabletop randomization RPG that was, like, the game he had always wanted to create, because that's what he came into Final Fantasy having been a fan of. You know, all those River Hill Soft tabletop games. Like, that was his background. Mm-hmm. He was the most grognard, hardcore tabletop RPG fanatic of anyone making early Japanese RPGs. And so, like, you know, Sakaguchi leaves and he's like, this is my moment. This is finally why I've been holding on for all this time. 15, however many years of seniority and experience, the corner office. This is it. And God bless him.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, you call it cashing in his chips, and man, what a gamble, because, like, he's still there. They're still making Saga games. People love him. Like, it worked out. It still worked out.
But, you know, the Saga games still do just this random cruel bullshit. Like, Saga Scarlet Grace, the most recent to come out, is actually the most approachable and friendly of all Saga games. And yet, It still has invisible level scaling. So this totally open game. You can walk around on the map, which is, you know, very kind of abstract, just like a map style pinpoint sort of thing. You can cruise around, fight enemies, you know, trying to level up and stuff. But there's kind of this world tendency thing going on. And after you fight enough, the enemies start getting stronger and stronger. And you don't scale the same way they do. So if you don't beat a boss for a chapter and move on to the next chapter soon enough, eventually it will become impossible for you to clear that chapter because the basic ass enemies will just be way too strong and forget about defeating the boss.
Wow.
So this is not explained. It's just at some point you're like, huh, why am I not steamrolling these little random encounters that used to be so easy for me? I'm supposed to be getting stronger. What's happening? Well, what's happening is you got Kawazu'd.
Beautiful. I'm not too familiar with anyone because I'm not really an RPG guy, but was he the fellow who did Crystal Bearers, Final Fantasy Crystal Bearers? Oh, no,
yes,
that's
sir.
A game. That's a game. Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, I had Unlimited Saga. I bought it randomly because all the reviews...
That's the way to do it.
Well, you know what it was? I think all of the reviews in, like, UK magazines that I was reading at the time were just like, that noise, basically.
Right.
And I was just like, willfully, like, obscurus, like, contrarian. And I was just like, yeah, I'm going to give that go. And also, you know, it was cheap because nobody bought it. So it immediately became cheap. And it had really lovely, it was like in a lovely cardboard box with like a nice plush kind of embossed logo and like a little book in like art all over it. And I was just like, ooh, lovely. This is very nice. And I think I played it once. And then that was just like, nah. There's no way. Now, see, the thing is, now I really want to try it again because I wonder if maybe now I might be like, maybe.
But, you know, probably not. You think that's the case, but even going into the game, knowing full well what I was getting into and being, at least in theory, a supporter of all that is Kawazu, I still found this just, it's tough to love. It really is, like Ray said, too random. It's like dice rolls the video game. Dice rolls for everything. It's rough. It's really challenging.
Like, takes away player agency at a certain point when it's all dice rolls.
That kind of sounds all right to me because, like, one of my favorite Game Boy Advance games is Mega Man Battle Chip Challenge.
Just watch a Let's Play then. Why even play the game if
because
it's all
I like
random?
To pretend like I'm skilled, you know. I can just sit there holding the buttons and just going, oh, yeah, I'm absolutely beasting this.
There is something nice about not having to take any accountability whatsoever for the outcome of the game you're
playing. Exactly. It's not my fault if I lose. I haven't lost.
That's one way to look at it.
Yeah. The game has lost. And if I win, I'll take the credit.
All right. So, Stuart, what is the next pick you have on your list? Something you have played and find unspeakably cruel.
Yes, I'll keep it sort of briefer this one, but I want to talk about Chip's Challenge, which was one of my favorite PC games as a kid, and I want to talk very specifically about a few of the levels in it, because if you haven't played Chip's Challenge, what it is, it's a conversion of an Atari Lynx game by, I can't remember the name of the company, but the designer's name is Chuck Somerville, and
Epix,
that's the one. Yeah, I don't know why I can't remember that, it's really obvious. Little fella walking around collecting computer chips in what can only be described as, God, well, I don't even know how to describe it. It's like Frogger, but like puzzles. Like, you move one square at a time and, you dodge like bugs and you've got a like, soccer bun. It's like big soccer bun.
I was gonna say, it's a soccer bun, right?
Yeah. It's sort of. There are soccer bun bits, but there's also dodging things and logic gates and like toggle switches and all sorts of things. Zelda-ish, but with no combat, I guess you could say. And all you can do is move and push things. That's it. And it's great. I loved it. Because I especially loved it because I had it on a Windows 3.1 computer, which was mostly just stuff like, Minesweeper. And then suddenly there's this game that's got all like ideas and levels and cool, fun things. And like, yes, let's go. And, other than the first 10 levels, which are training levels, like explicit tutorial levels, every single stage is completely self-contained, presenting a certain type of challenge, whether it's a maze sort of thing, or it's like being chased by monsters sort of thing where you have to react quickly, or a soccer band style level where you have to push blocks into water to create a bridge to the exit, that sort of thing. Fair way into the game, there's a level, maybe level 40-odd, and there's a level called Blobnet, which is a bunch of box rooms of about, I want to say, maybe 9 tiles or 4 tiles a piece, and they have they're bordered by computer chips alongside gravel, and gravel is, if you're standing on it, you can't be hurt. So it's basically the only time you can be hurt is when you're in that space with those computer chips, or if there's nothing there, if a monster's there, you'll get hit. And up until this point, all the monsters that you've seen follow established patterns. Like, there are bugs that will always follow the right wall, to the wall to the right. There are paramecia that will always follow the wall to the left. There are walkers that will always turn left when they hit a wall, that sort of thing, you know?
Mm-hmm. So Choo-Choo Rocket, basically.
Pretty much. The blobs move randomly, entirely randomly, one tick at a time. And there are something like 88 chips in this stage. It's this huge repetitive... You're essentially running a checkerboard, sort of, collecting these chips, except whenever you've got one, that space is now empty, which means the blob, 1 in 4 times, is going to be in that space, and it's random whether or not he'll be there when you're there. So if you don't... Well, I'll put it this way. There is no way to do it and it be safe. It's not possible. So you will eventually reach a point where you've got to make multiple 1 in 4 death runs across these spaces. And, you know, those odds aren't good.
That's an exponentially ridiculous probability issue there.
It's not great. You know, it's not great. The thing is, I'm sure that there are, like, pro strats that would avoid this, but I don't know those pro strats. You know, I'm not part of that community. But for me, that's the tip of the iceberg, because later there's a stage called Totally Fair, which is basically what you have to do is manipulate this monster into following you so it stands on a switch, and that's fine. You know, it's not easy because there's another monster outside of the area you're manipulating that's trying to catch you. So it's a bit of a run around, you know. It could be get frustrating because you might accidentally lead the monster in a wrong direction, but like, whatever. It's doable. It's difficult. By that point, you don't care. And then maybe, six or eight stages later, there's a level called Totally Unfair, which completely mirrors that stage's layout, except you're blocked off from getting into the area so you can see the monster. You have to memorize the solution from that previous level and execute it without being able to see what's happening above you. And this is a game that, while it does have passwords, there's no other way to go back and forward to levels that you've been to memorize that. So you could, if you knew the password, yes, you can jump back and you could check it out and then jump forward and try and recreate it. But like, even that's a pain in the, like a real pain in the neck. Like, and to be honest, part of you is going to be thinking like, no, surely that's not what they expect me to do here. There's got to be some kind of like clue somewhere. Mm-hmm. And there are a couple of small changes to the layout that do indicate like how far up and down you've got to go, but like that's it. And it's not just up and down, you know? And that level of just like, I'd never seen that before and I've never seen it since. That kind of remember the exact solution from a previous stage, and not just like how you do it. I'm talking how many steps you take, in which direction, and when.
Holy shit.
I've never seen that before or since. And in a sense, I want to stand up and I want to just say, well done. You found a puzzle within a puzzle within a puzzle. And I really like that in a way. I can't help but kind of like that.
That is impressive, yeah.
And honestly, I mean, there are other levels besides that that are just tedious, but that is the one that stands out for me as just, like, cruel. Really cruel, I think. I want to keep that brief at Chips Challenge. Pretty much that's it for me from that one.
You know, I've never made it that far in a Chips Challenge, but that sounds horrible.
It is, yeah.
The closest thing I think I've ever experienced to something like that in a video game is when I played all the way through Chrono Cross in Japanese. And, you know, to find the true ending in Chrono Cross, spoilers here for a 25-year-old video game.
I haven't played it yet, 20, no.
I'm going to be really Chrono
I played Chrono
Cross.
Trigger recently.
Okay.
I'll take my headphones
so,
off.
So, one, it's 25. But two, okay, so I'll just say there is a sequence that you need to execute based on your actions. And this is actually kind of told to you explicitly in one room, kind of in a sort of out of the way place that you actually do have to go to during the course of the game. So if, you know, you're playing the game and you read the language, sure, that's fine. That's cool. But if you're an idiot who's like, I love Chrono Trigger so much, I'm going to play through Chrono Cross in Japanese before it comes out in the US so I can get the experience and I'm going to write a fact about it. If you're that dumbass, well, that's a real challenge, because you get to that final encounter and maybe it occurs to you like, huh, there's something happening here that's different than other battles. And I think I remember where I experienced this before, but I'm in the middle of this battle and there's no way to go back to that place and have that conversation and see what I'm supposed to do here for certain. So I guess I'm not going to get the true ending. So that was, that was my own fault, so I can't really count that.
Yeah, but, I was going to say, you trolled yourself there.
I did. Yeah. But you know, that idea of like, hey, here's a thing that you see once, and then a few hours later, you're going to need to recall it and do it again.
That's wild.
That's a little rough.
Mm. But
not quite on the level of Chip's Challenge.
So just to keep it super quick, I will mention there's a very similar thing in my opinion, in Alex Kidd in Miracle World when you get the Rosetta Stone, which tells you how to beat the puzzle on the final stage. The problem is it was not correctly localized, so it's right to left, and there's no indication that that's the case.
Oh, great.
Duh.
I mean, let's face it, no one's getting that far in Alex Kidd anyway, so it's not really that big of a deal. But you know, it's there.
No, I was actually had that on my list, so I'm glad you mentioned it.
Oh, sorry.
No, it's fine. You actually said it better than I could. But there is one other factor, which is that to input the Rosetta Stone sequence, even if you know it's supposed to go right to left, it's done through platforming. So you have to make very precise jumps onto very specific tiles in a specific order in order to beat the game.
With the slippery ass controls on the Master System D-pad.
I didn't want to say it, but you're right.
No, it's okay.
It's the physics.
I hold my hands up. I've just said I love Ollie and Lisa. I am well aware of the flaws of my chosen systems. I mean, that's even if you get the Rosetta Stone, because to get it, you need to get the letter from the castle, and that doesn't. You might just miss it. It's in a random room. Oh, what a game!
Holy shit!
Banger game.
Jess, what's next on your agenda?
Permission to be on my bullshit.
Please.
For Silent Hill bullshit.
This is gaming's bullest shit, after all.
Well, I mean, this is like the least retro of like anything on this list is all I'm saying. But
Silent Hill is 25 years old also.
Now it's retro, but it's like the least oldest of a lot of these things we're talking about. But I just know too much about it. So here I go. There is a puzzle in Silent Hill 3 this is so funny because you're bringing up a bunch of different things that like kind of funnel into this story. We're bringing up programming errors, Brady Games guides, localization issues. We got it all, guys. This is incredible.
This is the greatest hits.
This is the greatest hits, everything.
We're peaking early is what you're saying.
It's just very relevant to all the things that just got mentioned. But there's a puzzle in Silent Hill 3 that is so hard that fans have been inventing justifications for why the answer is what it is for like 15 years. And like, it's not even the Shakespeare puzzle, which is like very famous, the hardest puzzle mode. It starts you off. The very first puzzle is you have to know 5 Shakespeare plays. I haven't read King Lear. Whatever. I play video games. I don't know the Bard. Whatever. But like the
man, I thought my T.S. Eliot reference at the start was going to be the most literary we were going to get. But no. You just eclipsed me.
But I'm skipping that because that puzzle is bullshit. Because I think to be a fair puzzle, it should be self-contained. It should be in the room with you. You should be able to, if you're 13 years old and you've only read Romeo and Juliet, fuck you, kid. That sucks. You can't solve it. But I'm not talking about that puzzle. I'm talking about the hospital keypad puzzle, which is a bit later in the game. So it's this, you find this really gory, gross poem about cannibalism, about eating somebody's face. Ew. So you read this poem in this spooky ass hospital, and there's no numbers in this poem. But next to the poem is a numbered keypad to access this whole wing of the hospital that you need to go to progress the game. So you kind of have to surmise from the poem, like, how do I get numbers from this thing? What if a human face can kind of fit on a, 3x3 keypad if you squint? And that is basically what you're supposed to be doing, right? Maybe like 1 and 3 could be the eyes, and 5 is the nose, and 8 is a mouth, and stuff like that. Sure, but like something screwy here with the answer, because for the answer to actually work, the ear has to be like under the cheeks, which is wrong from the other side. It's like opposite on the other side of the face here. So like, what the fuck? So it turns out that whoever was in charge of programming the solution into the game just put it in wrong. And like, they goofed up, and there's a 1 instead of a 4 in this puzzle by accident in the solution to this. And Silent Hill fans have been justifying this messed up face for goddamn years to make up for a programmer's fuck up. And the Brady Games guide also like has a very convoluted explanation for why, of course, this is the answer, of course. Because like when you make a Brady Games guide, apparently, they send you the game early and they go, here's the game. And like, you can kind of ask them questions, like translated questions between like America and Japan. And it's just like, there's some mishaps happening there, but this isn't even one of those things. It was just a guy in the black box of Konami or whatever, just hit one instead of four and ruined this code for everybody. Mm-hmm. So I've seen people posit that, you know, the person whose face you're eating in this poem, well, they're dead, so they're lying down on their left side. And that's why the blood goes that direction. No idea why these numbers correlate that way, because it doesn't make sense. They screwed up.
Is it explicitly a human's face and not, like, for example, a Basset? Because then maybe you can make this work.
Now, it seems to be, like, from a stalker's perspective, so it's very, like, you know, like, icky, like, romantic.
Right.
Definitely about, like, someone he had a crush on and was stalking.
That doesn't completely rule out it being a Basset, but it makes it less likely.
Well, like, you'd think that this would be caused by a translation goof-up. But or the fact that like the translation team would be working with a computer keypad, which the numbers go the opposite way of a phone keypad. So it's like, oh, maybe that's why this got messed up. But like they actually like the localization team checked with the art team. It's like, okay, this definitely goes the other way. Okay, good. We're squared. And then some programmer screwed up.
Oof.
They took all that effort and some programmer screwed up the code. And there's no feedback for putting the code in right. You can click these numbers for ages. You don't know how long the code is supposed to be. It's four digits long, but it doesn't stop you from putting in more numbers after that. And there's also, to top it all off, there is some note somewhere in the hospital that says, the doctor has the code. You'd think four would be enough, but he kept going. Which implies it's longer than four digits. Oh, what a nightmare.
What the fuck?
Yep. Bad.
You would think, meaning you should think.
Yeah. Whoops.
I have to ask, and I apologize if this undermines this at all, but was this one of the games where you could choose the difficulty of the puzzles and it changed
Absolutely.
The solutions?
Absolutely. You can't do it on the fly, though, I don't think. You can't, like, change it mid-game.
Okay.
So you're kind of, once you get past the Shakespeare puzzle, you're locked in.
Right, okay.
And that's in the same level as another puzzle that is also technically, it's not broken, but we've been solving it wrong for 15 years. It's also been justified the wrong way because the Brady Games guide was like, oh, of course, this is why it's like this. Ooh, they didn't know. They were guessing too.
So this is the Silent Hill that no one likes, right?
Not yet.
No.
That's the fourth one.
Oh, okay.
And what then about? Everyone after the fourth one.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Normal fandom over here.
Mm-hmm. Yep. All right. Well, I'm going to take it back in time a little more to keep ragging on NES games, mm-hmm. ranting about them, because I just keep encountering so much BS. So Predator for NES, hands up if you've ever played this game. It is Go on.
No, I was going to say, is it the same as the Master System one? But probably not, right?
It is not. Nope.
Okay. All right. That sucks too.
It was actually apparently produced by the same development company that created the Rambo NES game, which I kind of like.
Yeah.
I've talked about that a lot on the show, so I'm not going to talk about it here. But apparently they actually subcontracted it to a company called Clone, who didn't have a lot of experience making video games. And they did some really technically cool stuff with Predator. Like, if you've never played it, you know, part of it is a bad kind of standard NES platformer where you're running and jumping and you're Arnold Schwarzenegger, but you have a terrible selection of weapons and you're very limited in what you can use. You might accidentally pick up a grenade and then you have to like throw a grenade and wait for it to explode at an enemy in order to progress. Just terrible, but, you know, kind of standard fare for this era. But it also has something called Big Mode where you are playing a gigantic sprite, a gigantic sprite of Schwarzenegger.
Yeah.
It kind of looks like, you know, it's like the same scale as the Kung Fu on, or what is it? What's the name of the game? On TurboGrafx?
China Warrior?
The China Warrior. Yes, China Warrior. I think it's called the Kung Fu in Japan.
Yeah, the Kung Fu.
Yeah. The Kung Fu.
The Kung Fu? Wow.
There's only one.
That's the Kung Fu.
Yes.
Wow.
The definitive article.
Meeting a celebrity. The Kung Fu.
Exactly. So, you know, it's really impressive to see. Technically, he's like you're playing a background tile as opposed to a sprite. But still, it's really impressive. It still sucks as a game, but it's impressive looking. However, like, yeah, the big problem is they had a lot of apparent technical expertise with the NES. They were really good at doing stuff that you hadn't seen before, but not so good at the level design. And there is a level that I got to, and even with cheat codes for invincibility and things like that, I was absolutely stumped. How can I possibly beat this stage? Nothing that I did or cheated to do seemed to work. And it turns out the answer is that there's a door, which you can see, but it's kind of in an alcove, and there's a platform over top of it, and then it kind of comes around underneath, and there's a platform leading up to it, but you can't actually jump high enough from that lower platform to reach the door. But because this isn't like a Contra, I mean, it looks like it wants to be Contra, but it's not Contra. So you can't jump down through the, you know, through the platforms by pressing down on jump. You just, Arnold Schwarzenegger's too beefy to do that. So it seems like there's no way to get there. But actually, there is an enemy that like throws projectiles at you that's stationed kind of above the door. And the platforms above the door are sort of uneven. They like, there's like a rise. So they're, you know, like if you look at background tiles, there's like a row of background tiles, and then a platform kind of ends and starts again at the row of tiles above that. Okay. So the way to beat this level is to stand at that kind of junction where the platform rises, and there's not a gap, but there's a corner. And then you wait until the projectile throwing enemy throws a projectile at you. And when the projectile hits you, the knockback will push you through the platform and cause you to clip
Christ
through.
Christ almighty.
Wow.
And then you will fall down to the door.
Is that intentional?
I thought this couldn't possibly be the solution. But the only solution I can find in facts for the game say, this is what you do.
Get out.
So you have to exploit a knockback glitch in order to complete the stage. Now, there are multiple paths to the game. Like it kind of branches at some point. So there's like two possible paths you can go through. This is one of them. But I can't imagine a child or an adult in 1989 playing this game and saying, you know what I really need to do to finish this is deliberately take damage and glitch. Yes, that seems like a wise and sensible solution. No, you're going to get down there and you're going to be like, I can't jump up there. There's no way to get up there. This is stupid and impossible, and turn off the system.
A red herring or something, yeah.
It's, I mean, maybe I'm overlooking something. By the point that this episode comes out, I will have published a video about this game. So I'm sure people in the YouTube comments will tell me in great detail, and with a very, very cordial and polite tone, that I missed something obvious. But as far as I can tell, and as far as people who have written about the game on the internet definitively can tell, that's how you beat stage six whatever, or whatever six of mm-hmm. Predator for NES. And that, my friends, is bullshit.
That's bullshit.
Absolute. Complete.
This is why programming is all fake. It really is just, you know, tricking rocks into thinking. That's all we're trying to do here. So,
well, these rocks did not think very well.
Yeah. Thank you, programmers.
Okay, well, I'll save the rest of my NES complaints for my next round. I'm feeling a little head up right now, so I need to calm down. So I'm gonna pass the mic over to Ray while I let my temperature come down a bit.
Sure thing. Well, I'm gonna talk now about one of my favorite PS2 games, which will sound crazy once I start talking, but it's The Nightmare of Draga, Fushigi no Dungeon. Now, this is a mystery dungeon game in the franchise alongside Shirin the Wanderer in the Pokemon Mystery Dungeon games. supervised by the same creators and everything, which give you randomly generated dungeons every playthrough and you lose all your stuff if you die, but you're expected to replay and level up. So you're moving and exploring dungeons, also with very turn-based rules of movement and such. But it's also meant to be a sequel to The Tower of Draga, which is the classic Namco arcade game, 1984. And in Tower of Draga, the stages are pre-made mazes with secret treasures that you have to find by doing certain actions. Like that early on, you have to like kill two black slimes or whatever, and the speed boots will appear at some point in the maze. And you have to go grab that and then grab the key to the exit door. And the thing is that in that original game, all those things, the enemies and the items, they don't always show up in the same spots every time, just that the maze is the same and the missions to get the items. So Nightmare of Draga follows this setup on top of having the mystery dungeon rules like leveling up and risking your inventory and stuff like that. But it's also actually counterintuitive to Mystery Dungeon because most of the game you are given preset dungeon maps. They're not randomized and a known special item still on each and every floor. And I don't think the special items change positions either in it. But really the whole thing is that this game is kind of massive. Now, Mystery Dungeon games are kind of long to begin with, even if you don't factor in, you know, having to restart and replay some of those parts of it. So the original Tower of Draga had 60 floors, 60 levels, which is a lot for an arcade game that is meant to, you know, torture people. But that's a different cruelty story. rather, in the Nightmare of Draga, it has four chapters. The first three chapters total 60 floors. And then chapter four alone is 60 floors. So that's 120 wow. floors of mystery and dungeoning right there. But keep in mind, these are not randomized layouts. I mean, I do have the strategy guide right here from Japan, and it has maps for every single floor, minus some of the boss ones, because yeah, I guess they're straightforward. So if you're like a Draga head, one of these old Draga heads from Japan, and you love taking notes, you'll be fine just with these pre-made mazes, right? So you complete the game, chapter four. It turns out there's a fifth chapter, and this time it is randomized. It is now actually a mystery and dungeon game. Hmm. After you did all of that, 120 floors, chapter five itself is 120 floors. So you are now in a...
similar to the original Draga? Like, once you beat the game, it's like, guess what, idiot? Double game. There's twice as many of the things you thought there was.
I think that was just in some of the home ports. Isn't that right, Ray?
Yeah, something like that.
Oh,
plus,
really?
There was also the arcade sequel, Ishtar. Return of Ishtar, yes. Which is about, the story conceit of Ishtar is like going down back through the tower.
which Valve would steal later for Half-Life 2 Episode 1.
Yeah. Okay. So it's 120 more levels in this special randomized version of everything. And of course, everything is like crazy hardcore and everything. And that's basically it. Except there's also like a hidden secret layer of dungeons in just the main game. Like in the first three or four chapters, there's like a whole section of the game called Another Dungeon. And this is also like randomized and probably even more hardcore than even this fifth chapter is. And I never even actually got a good read on how many floors there are. I think it is like just like extra stuff that you can do whenever. Sort of like the item worlds in Disgaea games.
Oh, dear.
Sort of a similar thought process there. And like you find these hidden exits in the main game in Nightmare Draga. And these will take you to one of the another dungeons, they call them. That's it. That's really it. I just wanted to tell you how much of a slog this game is, despite the fact that it's like the first half of it is like straightforward, right? Pre-made mazes just to have a map. You'll be fine. And then it's like, oh, now it's actually a mystery dungeon game. And you might have to be dying and repeating a lot more for about 240 levels of fun.
Ray, I think you actually overlooked the most infuriating thing about the American version of this game.
Oh, okay. Yeah, all right. I Please. Will go ahead and mention that as
like,
well.
That kind of falls in there with the the Ninja Gaiden Monster Party localization disaster, but it might be the worst of the localization screw-ups.
Yeah. So, I guess to set that up, first of all, you know, we didn't get a lot of Mystery Dungeon games in this country for quite a while. Until like the first Shirin game showed up on DS, right? And so it was like that and like the Torneko game for PS1.
Chocobo's Dungeon.
Chocobo's Dungeon, yes.
Pokemon too, but I think Chocobo was first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. And so a lot of people weren't used to it. And, you know, they were critically maligned. But they nevertheless, Namco decided to go ahead and localize The Nightmare of Jiraga. And the thing is that in the Japanese version of Nightmare of Jiraga, you can pull up the sub menu, just, you know, your regular menu, and you'll get a hint as to how you need to find these two special treasures on each and every floor. They took it out of the English version. It was too much for them. There was, I guess, a budget that had to be met, and they could not, in fact, translate all of these hints.
They couldn't even translate the title of the game. It's not Nightmare of Jiraga Mystery Dungeon. It's Fushigi no Dungeon. I'm the American box art. Like, Americans don't know what Fushigi no means.
Yeah. It's just like karaoke. Fushigi no.
This is one of those things that just makes me, raises many questions in my brain. Is this the one where when you, if you reset it, it yells at you for ages, like Mr. Rossetti style? Because it auto saves.
More or less, yeah. Okay. They do that, yeah. Because they copy protect the saves. So it's like also one of the few PS2 games where you just cannot copy the save over to a card willy-nilly.
Huh.
Yeah.
Really? Interesting.
Yeah. It's locked because it is very important that you play this game according to the rules.
I guess. Wow.
I mean, the thing is, I didn't even know this had been localized because I must have, I mean, in my searches, I must have seen that it was called Fushigi no Dungeon and went, well, that's not localized.
Yeah.
I was going to play it.
Is this the sequel to Fushigi Yugi? What is this?
It was also like localized fairly soon after the Japanese release, like only like less than a year, I think. So it was a few months between the releases. And so you're just like, you could have spent some extra time, I guess. I mean, well, apparently you had no faith in it to begin with, but like, geez, guys.
I mean, they could have saved more money by just not localizing it if they weren't going to do it with the stuff you need to finish the game. I'm not, you know, it's weird.
Yeah, Namco was doing some weird localization stuff at the time because like a year later, they released Mr. Driller for DS as a launch game, and they took out all the extra modes. They just had the arcade-style mode, mm-hmm. but there was a bunch of extra stuff in the Japanese version, and they were just like, meh, we'd have to localize item names. That's hard. Let's not do that. So you didn't get the quest mode.
I will also add that, you know, crowdsourcing hasn't also been kind to this game because you go to GameFAQs and it's just like one fact and the person did not finish it. And so all we really have is the Japanese strategy guide to go on for any sort of indication of what to do.
That's in Japanese.
Yeah, it is in Japanese. I know. It's it's a real, real pickle.
A real Fushigi no.
I do enjoy this game, actually. In terms of like the Mystery Dungeon stuff, it is just kind of fun to go through, and I'm just into the Jiraga stuff in general. So I'm not saying I've completed any of it or that I'm any sort of expert, or else I would be writing the fact, but not so much, not really. But it is, it's a game.
I'm going to have my Stuart moment here because...
very positive.
No, this is a positive thing. It's okay. I don't understand, like, this is going to make people say, I don't understand why that happened, but okay. So I was assigned to review this game when it came out for 1UP.com back in the early days of the site. And I was like, what the hell is this? And threw myself at it for like 12 hours because it was, you know, not a full review session. I did not complete this game. Let's not even pretend. But I liked it. I was like, huh, this is kind of interesting. And from that point, I actually liked roguelikes. This was the game that mm-hmm. made me decide roguelikes are neat and I like them. They're a thing I enjoy to a certain degree.
Oh, that's encouraging.
Yeah. Like even despite all of the cruelty and the complete lack of direction that the American version included, I was like, this is not so bad. It made me interested in Jiraga also. So, this was like a lodestone moment for me. Keystone.
Yeah, that's actually kind of, even on a smaller scale, that's quite reassuring because I wanted to give this a go. Like I saw some screenshots and I was like, hey, this looks like my kind of thing. And then I hear that the hint sheet's not there. So it's not really finishable. And I'm like, well, I guess I won't bother then. But now you're like, oh, this was the game that got me into these games. So I've got to be, well, there's got to be something there. I've got to give it a go.
From here, you can go on to mystery dungeon games that you can actually complete.
Didn't something similar happen with Breath of Fire Dragon Quarter? Like, they took some feature out that made it so much more palatable when they localized it, or am I completely imagining this?
Oh, I don't remember.
Hmm.
I don't believe so.
Well, the listeners will know. Listeners of Retronauts, assemble.
Anyway, so thank you, Ray, for walking us through that nightmare.
Hopefully I can have someone get into Nightmare of Jiraga and we'll all translate these hints together.
Please, help. Stuart, what's your final pick for this episode?
Oh, I've got to pick one. I've got so many unbelievably brilliant ones as well. No, you know what? I'm going to go with something a little bit. Like, not the actual main game's challenge, you know. It's like the kind of challenge for someone who's a completionist. I'm going to talk about Crash Bandicoot 4. Now, hands up, this is not actually a retro game, but it's a sequel to a retro game that is sold on the fact that it is finally the fourth game in the retro series, and specifically throwing back to the classic Crash Bandicoot gameplay that we all missed so much. So I want to talk about Crash Bandicoot 4, because it's also like smashing your own face in with a rock, to be honest. Now, here's the thing. The Crash Bandicoot games 1, 2, and 3, I'm very fond of those games. I hold my hands up to the fact that they are... If you weren't there, they're very unappealing, I think. I think it's hard to be Crash fan like now, unless you already were one. Because he's quite a bad character. But I liked them, you know.
But he shouted at Nintendo headquarters. I don't understand.
I did that, do I get on an advert? No, I do time. But Crash Bandicoot 4 finally released a few years ago now to much great fanfare as the final, finally recognizing the quality of Crash Bandicoot. In a brand new platforming adventure that throws back to these original three platform games. And what stands out for me about the original three Crash games is that they are games that I have gone back to quite frequently because they're quite easy to blast through. They're not necessarily super easy games. Like, there's some slightly unreasonable difficulty going on in that first one, but
yeah.
It's the kind of thing where once you're good at it, that sounds a bit dismissive, but once you're there, like, you're okay with it, you know what I mean? It's like, well, I know this is a bit unfair, but this is the bit I'll push through and then everything will be fine. Mm-hmm. And you can 100% those games in like 4 hours, maybe, maybe not including the time trials, and I'm not doing the time trials, I don't have time for that.
Mm-hmm.
Get all the gems, 100%, it's nice and it's rewarding, you know, there are some challenging moments, but it's designed that people can finish it. You know, and they'll be pushed and there'll be some frustration, but you'll make it to the end and you'll be done. And it's a breezy, enjoyable thing. That's why people like these games. That's why people go back to them. Crash 4 is like wading through a swamp full of piss. I cannot with this game to use the parlance of the youth of today. What is different about it is the goals are essentially the same in that make your way to the end of the stages, and for 100% completion, you want to get all of these gems. You need to collect all these gems, and to get the gems, you have to break all the boxes in a stage. And, you know, in the original games, you'll have, I'd say maybe 40 boxes in a stage. Maybe the later levels, you might get up to maybe just over 100, maybe. Crash 4, I think, like, the first level's got like 160 or something. And if that's not your immediate kind of like, oh, okay, like something's gone wrong here, is the fact you reach the end of the stage and it's sort of like you've got 149 out of 150 boxes, so you don't get that gem. You do get the gem for getting enough fruit, and there's also two more gems you can get by A, beating it without dying like three or more times, and some other final thing, like just one hidden one in the stage somewhere. So first of all, you're like, so right, okay, well, I missed one gem, one box. Now, the problem is the way it works is you can't just go back and get that box. You've got to get them all in one run. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's what makes it challenging. In the old games, that was kind of okay, because that's what makes it challenging. There's a few moments where you're kind of mad, but they're designed that way. There's always got to be at least one level that's annoying, because that's how that's what's memorable, right?
Yeah.
But Crash 4, it's like, you go back and you're like, where's this one box? And it turns out, It's behind a step and it's invisible. You can't see it because it's behind a step, like a downward step. And mm-hmm. it's a linear facing game where you can't move the camera backwards. So if you don't know it's there already, you won't be able to get it. That's not fun. That's annoying. That's not like...
unlocking memories that I purposefully forgot about Crash 4. Like, when you started talking about Crash 4, I was like, oh yeah, I didn't play that. I did. I hated it so much that I just deleted it. I forgot all about it. But yeah, it was fucking bullshit. It was so rude.
It's like, the defense for this is... just don't get 100%. Like, no.
No.
It's Crash Bandicoot. I always got 100%.
It's also like, it felt like, you know, and Crash 3 is my favorite for what it's worth, but like, it felt like there was a difficulty curve of 100%ing where it's just like, you could go through the first couple of levels of a given set, because there was like five or six of them in the little like set of each little spoke, and you could just do it in one run. You could just get all the things, and it wasn't this like really obscure place you had to get to or something. Like there, and then later on, there'd be harder ones where it's like, oh, that's a mystery. How do I get all the way over there? I have no clue. And like, it felt reasonable because they saved the tricky ones for last. It felt like Crash 4 was right out of the gate. Fuck you. You're not getting all these boxes. If that was something you liked as a kid, fuck you. You're not going to get that.
the thing with Crash, the old Crash games, is this isn't universally true, but generally if you missed a box, you could go back and get it. And if you couldn't, the levels weren't very long.
They were
2 minutes long.
Dude, these levels were so long in Crash 4. Oh my god.
I'm sorry.
And the checkpoints weren't that good.
I'm really sorry that I've dug this up from the depths of hell.
It's all coming back to me.
But, I mean, that's like the half of it. I'll keep it quick, but like, once you figure out to get these six gems, the problem is, when there's a gem for dying three or fewer times, dying four times is the most annoying thing in the world.
Yeah.
Like, why do that? Like, why even add that? It's just, it's shit. It's just adding shit for no reason. Like, these levels are hard. Getting all the boxes is hard. Isn't that enough?
what do you want from me?
Yeah. But like, yes, you can get a gem and then you don't have to get it again. That's great, right? But that means that if you are trying to get all the gems and you do lose three lives, you're just like, well, that's fucked. That's gone. That's done that wrong.
Yeah.
And that's frustrating. When you get to the end of a level, and I've talked about this before, but my least favorite thing in any platform game like that is when you get to the end of the level and you're like, Christ, that was really hard. And then the game just goes, you sucked. You did it so badly.
You missed two boxes. Moron. Idiot.
Moron. In knowing that that's not just a 2 minute dash, that's 15 to 20 minutes of poring over every detail everywhere because there are boxes off the screen behind things. You know that when you bounce on a box to break it, sometimes they put a box above the box off the screen, so you've got to do a high bounce off that
box. Off the damn screen,
And do a double jump to hit the box. Yeah. Now, then there are these things called inverted levels, which are the same levels again, except they've been mirrored, and you have to get six gems again to get 100%.
Oh my god, I'm so upset. I forgot about all this.
The problem with this, what it is it's just... shit, isn't it? It's just cruft. It's just piled on shit
because
they're like, we need to make this worth $60. Let's just pile on as much needless bollocks as we can. Like, let's make the players do all this crap. Like, here's what they needed to do to make the game feel worth $70 for Crash fans. Crazy. Is make a good Crash game. Yeah.
What's nuts is that, like, because the levels are so long, the idea that you can't die more than three times is like, okay, if that was a precedent, like... I don't think any of the other Crash games had any challenge of that sort.
Nothing like that.
Allowed to die. Screw it.
Oh, no. They did have the death platforms where you had to get to a certain point in the stage without dying, but they were generally quite near the beginning and quite reasonable.
Yeah, like, so, they weren't so ridiculous. It's like, okay, now you've got significantly longer levels with a really hard, parameter to fulfill, and it's like, this is way too much. Yeah.
And they're not even the levels, as well as being long, they're also very difficult levels. Like, with
so
lots
hard.
Lots of killing, lots of death. And, you know, you manage all that. You get these things called the flashback tapes, which require you to get to a certain point in the stage to get them. And then once you've got them, you unlock these awful 2D levels where all you're doing is breaking boxes. You see, it's all coming back. It's awful, isn't it?
But I deleted this so hard.
My actual least favorite thing about this game, like the peak thing that makes me the most pissed off about this game, and this is like the most annoyed I'm ever going to be on Retronauts, probably. Okay, here's right. I'm actually getting mad. Okay, I've got to stop and compose myself.
Oh boy.
Bonus
In the original Crash games, there are bonus levels, okay? Mm-hmm. Yes, you need to get everything in the bonus levels to get 100%, but they're bonus levels. They're just do-do-do-do-do, break some boxes, cut loads of fruit, get some extra lives. Yay, fun, nice, good. After the first one, the bonus levels in Crash 4 are deliberately designed to be like, nah, you can't get that box now, you stupid arsehole. You prick. You moron. So the bonus levels are actually just like significantly difficult, intentionally frustrating level design.
Kaizo and, levels.
Yeah, basically.
But, Crash 4 is Kaizo Crash, yeah.
Oh, man.
It's a bonus area. It's supposed to be bonuses, not...
Yeah.
It's not to be just a middle finger in my face.
Am I allowed to have fun in this game at any point, or is it just to make me regret ever playing
this? And what really sucks is I love the game feel, and I love the graphics, and that game made by people who weren't sadists, it could have been really great, and unfortunately... It was a load of old arse. I haven't even got into some of the stuff that sucks about it, because I don't want to go on and on and on, but... I mean, I could. And maybe one day there'll be an episode about Crash 4, which will just be therapy.
It'll just be me and you being like, what the fuck is this
shit? Being mad.
Being mad, screaming for 2 hours.
So, yeah, that's what I think is cruel about it. Not only to make a game that is pointedly, deliberately frustrating... about making as many missables as possible in a game that encourages you not to miss things. You know, it's not like it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I think, like, the biggest crime was that it made me question, do I like the Crash Bandicoot games? Like, it tainted my nostalgic, like, warm feelings for the original games. It's just like, I think I hate you, Crash.
Yeah. I think the worst thing about it is that other people like it, and I have to live in the same planet
as them.
So
you feel crazy, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, because I'm just... everyone's like, no, it's great, just don't bother getting 100%. And I'm like, that's a terrible cop-out, because there's no other content. That's the only thing to do in the game.
No, maybe the Call of Dutification of Activision led to something where it's like, yeah, just play Crash 4 for 40 hours a week and then Prestige and you're good, right? You'll love it forever.
Oh, God, they actually made that, didn't they? They made Crash Team Rumble, which was literally Battle Pass Crash Bandicoot.
Oh, God, yeah.
I memory hold that too.
I'm a huge Crash fan and I've not even touched that because no.
No, that's fair.
Damn.
Wowzers.
More like shit Bandicoot.
Get him. Drag him. Show him what for. Go back to Australia.
Stuart's finally upset.
We got there.
I wrote a book, All Games Are Good, Buy It Now, All Good Stores, well, mostly limited run on Amazon. But there's actually a chapter on Crash 4, and it's like the only bit of the book where I just talk about how bad it is. So that's the exception that proves the rule.
Wow.
It does make me like nostalgic for like some of the NES games we've been talking about, where it's just like, yeah, there's a hidden block that you need to get. And it's like in every level or whatever, you know, like like Mylon's Secret Castle. Mm. Those were the days.
I gotta recommend. There's a video by a YouTuber called Kid Icarus, who's infuriatingly young, but it's extremely good, like forensic discussion of why this sucks in a very entertaining way. So I'd recommend that basically. Or you could just ring me on the phone and I'll go on about it for hours. At you. Here's my phone number, +447. No, I won't give that up.
I feel like that's kind of the issue, though, when like nobody is making 3D character platformers for years and years, except like Nintendo, and everybody's just sort of like forgot
how to make the genre. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, it made me think that maybe Mario 64 isn't so bad after all. But sorry, that was just trolling.
In aggregate, yeah, pretty good. Oh gosh,
don't play Crash 4, kids.
All right, so we're going to wind down. I'm going to let Jess share her next pick for us, and then I'll bring it home.
Yeah, so I was going to talk about a famously bullshit, another maze, but it's from a game I also haven't played, so I feel like I really shouldn't talk about it. You should just watch the video I saw about how rude this puzzle is, but it's from Abduction, which I was meaning to play, but now I'm like, I don't think I'm going to play this if I have to deal with this in person. But you should watch, I highly recommend watching Second Wind's video, The Worst Puzzle of All Time, Design Delve. It's a simple maze that is made god-awful by just making it so you can't see how you're fixing the maze, basically, to really truncate that down. Oh. Instead, you should just watch that. Instead, I'm going to talk about something that is not retro, but it's not fair. And I'm also breaking the rules here probably because it's technically a mod.
So the rule on Retronauts is that we can talk about games once they're 10 years old. Mm-hmm. But the corollary is that eventually every game will be 10 years old. So go for it.
Listen to
Thank
this
you.
In 9 years.
Thank you for permission and forgive me, people who have not given me permission.
But it's part of a series that is retro, so it's fine. It's fine.
But it is part of a retro series. It's part of the Half-Life series. But Half-Life Alyx is the best fucking game I've ever played, right? I cannot gush enough about how much I love Half-Life Alyx. But I wanted more. So I'm like, oh, I hear there's some good mods for this. And the most recommended one that I saw at the time. I'm so sorry. I hate to, like, you know, kick an indie dev or anything like that. You know, that's punching down. But Half-Life Levitation fucking sucks, man. Because, so it's, you know, VR, all that stuff. The VR feels great, except, like, you know, if you're a big Valve fan, one of my favorite things about, like, Portal, Half-Life, et cetera, is that they have the developer commentary nodes that you can unlock and listen to all these this incredible insight, how hard they play test these things, all these things that they learned about, like, human psychology and human nature and human, you know, the body. What the body can stand to do in VR. And it's like, okay, like, you made a whole mod for this entire VR game. You must have watched the developer commentary. Oh, you gotta know the do's and don'ts, right? No. Motherfucker, whoever made this game did not do that, because there's more than there's multiple nodes that mention how difficult it is to portray motion in VR, because it makes people immediately sick. Like, your inner ear does not like to deal with this, right? So whenever you are in a moving thing in the actual game, Half-Life Alyx, if you're in an elevator, if you're in a train, you'll notice that they only give you these little tiny windows to look out from so that you're not, like, completely disoriented motion-wise. And this developer did not care about that, because there's elevators. There's all sorts of crazy shit going on. There is a part that was so mean that I I climbed a ladder in a train, a moving train. I had this really bullshit train sequence where it was already disorienting because the windows were huge and you have to shoot the guys on other trains through the windows. And I'm like so dizzy and I'm trying my best. And I'm like, okay, what now? I climb a little ladder. I'm on top of the train going like 80 miles per hour in a tunnel. And there's all the Combine, for some reason, left traps on top of the train, which does not make sense. Why would they do this? But you have to go around and, like, try to avoid all of these precariously placed trip mines on top of a moving vehicle. Like, I got up to the top of the train and, like, my knees buckled. Like, I can't explain how disorienting this is. Like, my knees just fucking gave out, and I was on the floor trying to deal with this part of the game through gritted teeth and half-closed eyes, and I was just like, why would you do this to me? Didn't you play the developer commentary? Fuck!
So were the mines, like, sellotaped to the top of the train or, like, something? Like, how does that work?
I've got nightmare.
Questions. Like, so they put them on there, and then, like, they were there at the station, and no one went, like, what are those things on top of the train that look like mines?
The Combine thought of everything. I don't know.
Yeah, don't worry about it. Oh, boy.
We got to mine the top just in case this idiot goes up there.
I have a headset, like an old Oculus thingy, and I want to play Half-Life Alyx, and I have Half-Life Alyx, and I booted it up, and I was like, oh my god, this is amazing, but I need to make space to play this.
Yeah.
And that was like 2 years ago, and I just haven't made any space, because you can't make space. It's impossible.
Make space.
All that happens is more things keep appearing, and nothing disappears.
I encourage everyone who has the means to play Half-Life Alyx, and even if you think your inner ear is really, really powerful, I recommend against playing Half-Life Levitation, unfortunately. The final boss was a nightmare, too. Don't get me started on that, but whatever.
I think it's cool there are mods for that. I didn't know that.
I know,
that
right? Like, I want to like this. My heart was broken, and then I was just mad about it.
Is it as good as Rick and Morty Virtual Reality?
I would not know, unfortunately. That one went under my radar.
Oh, you mean the best game ever made?
Mm-hmm, under my radar.
After, second best after other Rick and Morty game, I guess.
Yeah. I guess, you know, it speaks to, like, the overall challenge of VR game design.
Yeah.
I feel like it was hard enough going from 2D to 3D, and now we have to, like, VR designers have to factor in, like, the inner ear, like you said. Like,
yeah, and, like, I don't expect an indie developer to be able to playtest things to within an inch of their lives, like Valve clearly does constantly, but it's, like, to not take in the lessons that Valve has learned and has said out loud to you, the player, that's bizarre. Why would you do this
Valve,
to me?
Like, there is reams of lessons learned over, like, the past 10 years of doing real VR games that you can build on and look at. To me, it's just a lot to go through, but yeah.
But it's like making a mod is a lot to go through, right? Yeah, so it's like, why not do a little bit more effort and just, like, learn the hard-learned lessons so you don't, you know, make me nauseous.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to wrap up this episode by taking us back into retro territory all the
way
back.
Go ahead. I went way off course there. Sorry.
It's all good. That sounded horrible, and I'm glad that I will never play that. So I'm going to bring things full circle also by talking about two games that are kind of related to things we've already discussed. So related to Nightmare of Draga, in a sense, is Hydlide. So Hydlide for NES. Basically the inspiration for Tower of Draga, and Tower of Draga was, of course, the inspiration for Nightmare of Draga. Anyway, Hydlide, I don't think people, you know, have played the NES game generally and said, oh, I think I should, you know, really decrypt this game and figure it out, because you pick it up, you start playing, and the first sprite or slime sprite you encounter kills you, and you start over from the beginning. You have to figure out how to manipulate the soft save feature, not a hard save, soft save, and then, you know, record passwords and stuff. So it doesn't make itself very friendly. But for my NES Works video, I did play most of the way through the game, but I had to tap out when I got to finding the third of three fairies you have to rescue. Because the first two are easy enough to get a hold of, but they're very random. Like, both of the first two fairies appear in trees. On specific screens, the trees are selected at random. If you press and search the wrong tree on the first screen, you'll be attacked by bees that immediately kill you.
That's just realistic.
On the second fairy, the trees themselves actually walk around. And if you search a tree, a walking tree that does not have the fairy, it will just kill you. So you have like a 1 in 6 chance each time of finding the fairy. Okay. BS. But it does have a soft save feature. So you get to that screen, you hit soft save, you know, from the save menu, and you die, reload the game. There are worse ways to play an NES game.
Yeah.
But the third fairy, to get the third fairy, you have to kill two wizards. Now, you can't kill the wizards with physical attacks. You have to kill them with a magic spell. You have like 6 magic spells, and only one of them will work. And it's not obvious really which one does it, but eventually you'll discover, oh, these guys are throwing fireballs. If I shoot them with a fireball, they'll die. But the thing is, if you shoot a wizard with the fireball spell, it will disappear, but then it will immediately reappear. The only way to kill them is to kill them simultaneously with the fire spell, which only flies horizontally across the screen. So you have to line up both of the wizards who are walking around hitting you, throwing fire spells at you, horizontally, simultaneously, on the same level as you, and in that instant, hit both the attack and defend buttons, or whatever it is, A and B, simultaneously, which is how you cast a spell. While that's queued up, which you have to do by, I think, hitting select, and you can't have it queued up for too long or it resets to the first spell in the list. So you have to hit both of them simultaneously with a spell that only flies in one direction. But the really cool part is that Hydlide takes place in, you know, the Legend of Zelda style screens. It's flip scrolling. So you walk to the edge of the screen, it flips over to the next screen. You're in a different space. So the wizards only appear in this one space, And the space they occupy is only about a third of the screen wide. So at most, I think the widest point where the wizards appear is like 5 tiles wide, maybe 6.
Oh my God.
Out of, you know, however many it is, 16 tiles or whatever on the screen. So you have barely any space to maneuver. They walk around at random up and down the length, the height of the screen. And so you have to survive long enough to line them up with the spell queued. And in the split instant they're on the line with you and haven't killed you, lower your defense, cast the spell, and hit them both. I spent about 20 minutes trying to do that, and it sucked, and I hated
it.
And I knew going into it, I looked in a FAQ, because I have no idea where I'm going to find these fairies, and it said, this is what you have to do. Even knowing that, it was pretty much next to impossible. Like, I can't imagine having the patience to do that. But I also, even more than that, can't imagine ever stumbling across that solution without a strategy guide, without tips of, you know, any sort, like some sort of spoiler to say, this is what you need to do, because that is not a task you are going to attempt. You are going to cast a spell that maybe kills a wizard, and you're going to say, oh, he reappeared. I guess these guys just can't be killed. There must be, you know, these are just a thing I have to avoid. No, there is a puzzle here, and it is not a puzzle that a normal human would intuit through any normal means.
And it's not like this is a game that will train you to think in this way. No. Yeah.
There's nothing else like that. There are no other enemies you have to kill simultaneously.
Yeah.
In fact, to that point, there's no real reason to use magic, period.
Huh.
So that was when I had to discover, how do I even cast a spell? Because I see there are magic spells at the bottom. I have a magic meter, but what's the point? Not really much of a point. So anyway, that's Hydlide.
Wow.
But we're going to end this. Does anyone want to add anything about Hydlide before I bring up my last
one? Well, I think other than that little moment, what you said about the soft saving stuff, I think that does make Hydlide playable. Mm-hmm. More playable than people have let on over the years. Mm-hmm. And so, and it is also kind of an important game in early mm-hmm. RPG spaces. Mm-hmm. So it's not quite as hard to get through, even the NES version. So I'm
you can
accept that.
Accept
what you were just
talking about.
You can get this on the egg console on the Switch now, but I think it's one of the computer versions, isn't it?
So yeah, it is. Yeah, it's the original. Probably the X1 or something.
I will say,
so it's probably even less friendly.
There's they had a remake of the first three on Windows 95, much like how they did with the East Chronicles. And so if you can stomach trying to boot that up in a VM or something, it's on the Internet Archive. So you can find Hydlide 1, 2, 3. I would just recommend trying those versions other than just going with the NES. But yeah,
I want to play the Saturn one where you're a fella and it's like FMV.
Virtual Hydlide.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Virtual Hydlide. Yeah. I mean, that game is just rules.
Look at it. Look at it. Come on.
Yeah. That game is amazing.
So I want to bring up at the very end here, perhaps the most obvious and famous of BS games, which is Atlantis No Nazo for Famicom, which almost came to the U.S. as Super Pitfall 2.
Yeah.
But we were spared.
Oh, my. Yeah.
So Atlantis No Nazo is a difficult game. Sunsoft's designers sat down and said, Super Mario Brothers is very popular. Let's make our own take on Super Mario Brothers, but let's make it even harder. We're going to make 100 stages, and the whole thing is going to be about finding your way around and, you know, decrypting secrets and basically trying to figure out the way to the end. So the 100 stages are not linear. You have to travel around through different doorways. It is consistent. There is a path through the game. It's not an easy game or a fun game, but the design does at least have some ambition to it, and it's consistent. you know, you have to learn how to use your attack, which is a little bomb that you throw and it rolls along the ground and will blow things up.
Bomb.
But a lot of enemies will see the bomb coming and hunker down beneath a shell or something and it won't hurt them. So that's always fun. Birds will poop at you. You know, it's that kind of game. But there is one level called Zone 44, the 42nd of 100 stages. And once you reach that stage, you die. There's no two ways about it, because this zone is called the black hole, and it literally is a black screen. You spawn midway through the screen, and you fall to the bottom and die. And then you spawn for your next life at the same spot.
That's so
mean. And die.
You jet set away.
So the thinking behind this game was,
I've never heard of this before. Holy shit.
You know, kids own this game. They don't have to go to the arcade and put 25 cents in. They've paid their money. So we can make this as arbitrary and unfair as we want. So they literally just added a screen that if you go to that stage, you will die. So you must learn never, ever to go to that stage. Avoid the door that takes you there, because that's it. That's the end of the game. And you have to start all over and find your way through the 100 stages from the beginning again.
Wow.
And that is just unbelievably, almost like admirably cruel.
I'm impressed.
I think it's evil. It's kind of beautiful. Like, this was not an error. This was not a clipping glitch. This was just the designer saying, you know what? We can do this. And kids just have to suck it up.
You know, I'm looking at an image. I'm looking at an image of this screen. And not only does it say black hole, it has a little exclamation mark, like it's happy that you came here to die. Black hole! Yay!
It's kind of metal in a way, isn't
it? Fuck you!
You did it. You got an arbitrary game over.
Oh, man.
I mean, the whole thing of spawning and then dying again immediately is just like, you know, it makes me go, ooh, Spectrum, because that's a very common thing back then. I mean, my only experience with this game, and Retronauts, kids with your bingo cards, get ready. I watched Corone play it. She played it for 12 straight hours and finally beat it. So let's say well done to the VTuber. Yeah.
All right. I watched Arino play it, and he's not a VTuber, but that is a classic episode of Game Center CX.
Did he end up beating it?
My memory's foggy because I have to think about it right now.
Don't spoil the ending.
Okay, fine. Yeah. Let's let the kids figure this out. I've seen that episode too, and I can't remember. So
I don't remember. Yeah,
I mean, you know, it's one of those things where it's sad, or he got one of the ADs to do it. So
sure,
I don't remember which of any of these. I don't remember, like, every single Game Center episode. I do not remember any of which ones he actually succeeded on. Like, it's a surprise every time I watch one of these, even if I've seen it before.
I look at the old episode guide, and yeah, he beat it. So
okay,
good well for done. Him.
I'd also say this game was so crucial to history that they immortalized it on the Famicom Classic Mini. And like, the only other game that would have taken that spot was Spelunker. It's not on that. So it's Atlantis Nonazo as like the figurehead of Kusoge on the Classic Mini there, which I think is just beautiful.
Yep.
It's the end of history. And before this game, there was no such thing as a black hole.
Yeah. It's true. They invented it. The Disney made a movie about it.
Yeah. Scientists call it spaghettification when you enter the black hole.
That sounds delicious. So it's actually, it really does kind of bring it back to Mario. Anyway, nice. Thanks everyone for listening to this Retronauts episode. I hope you have enjoyed our tales of cruelty, our tales of ribaldry, and other assorted tales. I'd like to thank everyone who joined me this afternoon, this evening, for sharing your travails and your woes and your PTSD. It's been good. Purifying, you know, cathartic fun. And I hope people at home have enjoyed not having had to experience these games themselves. We did it for you. You're welcome. So if you enjoyed listening to these tales of sadness and misery and anger, well, I have good news for you. Retronauts is a podcast that happens all the time, once or twice a week, by God. So you can subscribe to Retronauts by going to pretty much any device that isn't Spotify and looking for Retronauts. And there we are, right there. But you can support the show by going to patreon.com/retronauts. And for just a few bucks a month, you can get every episode that we record and publish on Mondays for free, a week early, at a higher bitrate quality, with no advertisements or promotions besides us saying, hey, thanks for listening. And that's really cool. You can pay an extra $2, $5 a month, the price of like two-thirds of a latte at Starbucks at this point. And for that amount of money, you get free patron-exclusive, permanent patron-exclusive episodes every other Friday. There's like, God, like 100 of those now? We've been doing it for 4 years, so yeah. Mm. And then Diamond Fight does a column and mini podcast every weekend, and they've been doing that for several years, so there's hundreds of those. That's a lot of content for two extra measly dollars. It's I highly value. Recommend it. Yes, we are the value menu of podcasts. and unlike other things in the year 2024, we actually do mean value. So that's patreon.com/retronauts. That's my pitch for you. Thanks for listening. Everyone, where the hell can people find you and your projects online? Ray, it's been a while since you've been on, so please give us an update about where to find all things Ray Barnholt.
Yeah, sure. Well, I don't know about an update. I think I've said this before, but I have my site of links. You can go to rdbaaa.space and you can just get that whole layout of everything I've been doing and where you can find me on the social sites and all that. I will say, you know, if I have to stare down becoming a full-time Twitch streamer, I think I will take on completing all of Nightmare of Jiraga. That would just be like my Twitch career.
Wow.
We'll see about it. Because, you know, there's a cool retro streamer who is like 100%ing every N64 game. Something like that. Something that's like a career-making sort of Twitch project, I think, is going to be my thing. But we'll see. If I'm still unemployed in a year, I'll let you know. But yeah, otherwise, rdbaaa.space is where you can find all my stuff.
Oh, don't do that N64 one, because there's only about 40 games, and what you've done with that? Nothing. You've got nothing left.
Hardy har har, Stuart. Hardy har har.
The truth hurts.
All right. Jess, what about you? Where can we find you on the interwebs?
Yeah, I'm Jess O'Brien, but you can find me as Void Burger on pretty much everything that matters. Your Blue Skies, your Twitches and stuff like that, your YouTubes. My current big project. Also, you can go to voidburger.com and it's all my link tree and all the things and stuff like that. My big project right now that I'm doing is a D&D actual play podcast that's more like a radio play, because we put in all the sound effects and music, and it's so good. And by we, I mean me. I'm sound designing it. But it's a comedy horror podcast. I'm the sound designer, editor, and I am a slime in the party. So it's fun. It's good times.
Oh, nice.
Casey Green is on the staff of nice. Skull Tenders from This Is Fine fame, and he's funny as hell.
Stuart, how about you?
Oh, hello. I'm Stuart Jip, and you can find me on Twitter. X and Blue Sky. And you know what? Can I edit that out where I corrected it to X?
No.
I wrote a book called All Games Are Good, which is all about how I genuinely and sincerely love games with titles such as Era of the Acrobat and Kingdom Hearts 358 Days Over 2. And you can read all about why I'm wrong in the head and wrote those things down. A big fat book with 1,000,000,000,000 pages and a lovely hardback cover from Limited Run Games, a book so powerful that even when you're done reading it, you can use it to bolster things, physically bolster them, and kill people. Which was its intended use. That's why I created
it. This is admissible in court, you saying this.
We're not editing that out.
Oh, boy. Well, I guess none of that matters then in that case. Just whatever. I can just say what I want. I can't think of anything worth saying. That's it.
And finally, you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, on the internet as Jeremy Parrish, or on Blue Sky as Jay Parrish. Tricky, I know, but there I am. You'll find me mostly doing Retronauts, my YouTube channel, Jeremy Parrish, and at Limited Run Games, publishing books such as All Games Are Good by Stuart Jip. It's a cool thing that I do sometimes, and by sometimes I mean as my 9-to-5. So anyway, that's it for this episode. Thanks again for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, like I said, please support us on Patreon, or, you know, just listen to us for free and tell your friends about us. That's cool. But if you do support us on Patreon, in a few days, I have a patron-exclusive episode coming up, another Retronauts Radio episode where I talk about music. So if that's your thing, great. And if it's not, well, there will be other things coming along for patrons, so, you know, okay.
Cruel, cruel world, must I go on? Cruel, cruel world, I'm moving on. I've been living too fast, I've been living too wrong. I'm gone.